Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. State Attorney General Maura Healey and U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz are now reviewing the investigation into former Gloucester Police Chief Leonard Campanello. The Essex District Attorney says he's completed his review of Campanello's city-owned cell phone, and he's turned over matters to the AG and the U.S. Attorney. Campanello, who's retiring in January, is nationally known for the program that he started in Gloucester, where police help those struggling with substance use get into treatment. Joining us to talk about this and other legal cases in the headlines recently is WBUR senior legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. Hello.
Nice to be here.
So, Gloucester officials asked the Essex DA to review Campanello's cell phone after women came forward saying that they were concerned about their safety while having a relationship with Campanello. Now, first, Campanello was suspended, and when investigators went to get his cell phone, he said it was missing from his office. They later found surveillance tape showing that Campanello did indeed have his own phone, and they discovered that he had deleted texts to one of the women involved. What do you think it signifies overall that the AG and the U.S. attorney are reviewing this case?
Well, it certainly ratchets up the seriousness of the investigation because the kinds of charges that the U.S. attorney might have in her, that you could conceivably bring would be much more serious charges than the kind of charges that the Essex County DA would bring. So it certainly is a level of seriousness. It also means resources that the Essex County DA's office may not have, resources with respect to technology, analyzing cell phones, analyzing these kinds of records. So it's a turn to the more serious for the chief.
Now, when it was announced that the chief would be retiring, after it had been announced that he was being fired by Gloucester officials, his attorney said that he was retiring instead of being fired because they had reached an agreement regarding his contract. And also the attorney said that the agreement meant that all investigations into Chief Campanello were over. Can the attorney have even made that claim?
Well, he could only have made that claim if he actually had the agreement of all the relevant authorities as of the time of the agreement. And the relevant authorities here would have been DA, AG, U.S. attorney.
Right.
There's also another the potential for a civil suit, I imagine, from the women that are claiming that they were harassed. So he can't say that unless, in fact, all of those authorities signed on the dotted line to say this is over, no further prosecutions will come out of this. But even that's a hard thing to do because prosecutors rarely end investigations without having investigated.
Right.
So that's an unlikely scenario.
So let's talk about another case. This is a new development in the almost three-year-old murder case that rocked the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families, and that's the case of four-year-old Jeremiah Oliver. His remains were found in a suitcase off a highway in Sterling, and that was months after this little boy went missing. Now, Oliver's mother and her boyfriend, Alberto Sierra, faced charges of abuse, but no one's been charged with killing the boy. Sierra's attorney now is looking to try to prevent prosecutors from using statements that Sierra made to another inmate at the Worcester County Jail. So what's the issue here, and how common is the use of jailhouse informants, for lack of a better word?
Let me start with that question first. It's
okay.
Very common.
It is.
It's very common. It's a troubling practice for a whole host of reasons, since it's the testimony of a jailhouse informant against the defendant. And it's troubling because the informant is in a tremendously vulnerable situation. You get the goods on someone else, and it makes it possible for your sentence to be reduced. So it's a troubling situation that needs to be monitored. My understanding of what's going on here is that Sierra had a lawyer. The lawyer was known to the government. And the government in that situation can't do an end run around the right to counsel by contriving to have a jailhouse informant in the same cell as the defendant. Consider it this way. If I invoke my right to counsel, you can't talk to me anymore. The police can't talk to me anymore if I'm in custody. So they now can't get around that by just sending you to prison and sending you to jail, rather, and making sure that someone is in the jail cell with you that is talking to you. Right. That would avoid all the protections of the Sixth Amendment, which is the constitutional amendment involved here. So I think that's what he's saying, is that the government had a role in putting Sierra in a cell with a jailhouse informant whom the government knew and talked to, et cetera.
Are there, I'm assuming there are, very strict rules about what could be used as evidence to make sure that it hasn't been manufactured, because someone obviously has a vested interest in saying that someone said something while they were incarcerated together?
Well, I mean, rules are, what there is, there are two separate issues. So one is the question of, did the government put a snitch in Sierra's cell even after Sierra had invoked his right to counsel? Mm-hmm. That's one question. The second question is, even if that had not happened, but simply a jailhouse informant starts talking to Sierra and then bargains for his own freedom by testifying against Sierra, that's a harder there are no rules with respect to that. The lawyer will likely cross-examine the informant and talk about what he gleaned from that, you know, what he gained from telling about Sierra. But it will be up to a jury, for the most part, to determine who's to be believed. There are no concrete rules prohibiting it. There are no concrete rules that address that. It's really an interpretation. It's really for the jury to decide if that's a believable testimony.
You know, what does it suggest to you overall, though, that it's taken this long and no one's been charged with the death of Jeremiah Oliver?
Well, I mean, it could mean that they really don't have, they link him to the abuse, but they really can't link him to the murder. That's not a bad thing, that you want before charges are brought, you want government to dot the I's and cross the T's. So that's the issue here. I don't think that, I mean, it means it may be a complicated case, as abuse cases often are. Abuse cases leading to death are often difficult cases.
So let's switch gears here while we have time. Another case, this one before the Supreme Judicial Court, involving mandatory minimum sentences. This case is Commonwealth versus Lalta Prasad. And we should say that you are among counsel here. Lalta Prasad was sentenced to 1 year less than the statutory minimum requirement on drug charges. And the High Court ruled that existing state law does not provide a, quote, safety valve from mandatory sentences, and said the legislature needs to consider reforms. What do you make of this ruling?
Well, it's a very interesting case. It's a case in which the lawyers made two sets of claims. One was that the statute that set the mandatory minimum said that a judge could go below it according to the sentencing guidelines. The problem was that the Sentencing Commission had not issued guidelines for the circumstances of going below the mandatory minimum. But they argued that there was nevertheless the authority to do that. The court rejected it. The court essentially said that without guidelines, you can't go below the mandatory minimum. The court left open a very interesting constitutional challenge. A challenge essentially to cruel and unusual punishment under the state constitution, a challenge that a mandatory minimum on the facts of this case was out of proportion to what the defendant should get. We've seen challenges like that in other countries, where someone would get 10 years for a minor crime based on a mandatory minimum, and the courts would say that is a violation of the cruel and unusual punishment provision of the Constitution. It's a code name for proportionality. The court doesn't decide the constitutional issue because the record was not clear, but leaves open the door to proportionality challenges to mandatory minimums, which would be unique and extraordinary for it to do, to actually wade in that area. In the United States, we only challenge, for the most part, we've challenged penalties that are unusual, that are the death penalty or life without parole. Hmm. No courts, as far as I know, has challenged a sentence term of years, but the court kept the door open in the appropriate case.
Hmm. Does, as we said, the High Court also said the legislature should consider reforms. Do lawmakers tend to take heed of that when they hear that from the SJC? Has that been your experience in the past?
They may take it into account. Although what's interesting is the Massachusetts Sentencing Commission has hearings just yesterday on the question of what the content of a safety valve would be. A safety valve would mean mandatory minimums apply in all cases, except for a set of facts, and they'll issue guidelines as to what those facts might be that would enable a judge to go below the mandatory minimum. Now, it's very interesting that these proposals were coming out at the same time as Lalta Prasad. So while the legislature may not be paying heed to this, the Sentencing Commission is.
Just briefly, I understand that you're also following the fallout from the Sonia Farak case. She was a chemist in a state crime lab in Western Mass. She pleaded guilty to stealing and using drugs that she was supposed to be testing as evidence in criminal cases. Now, you've been looking at an affidavit that raises questions about when prosecutors found out that she had this problem and she may have been tampering with potential evidence and why they didn't act sooner. Is that right?
That's right. There was an affidavit that actually was filed in the Ducant case.
Annie Ducant, a former state chemist.
Right. Mm-hmm. For the purpose of showing the difficulties here, that the extent to which the government was not cooperating in turning over information about when the tainted evidence was generated. I want to pause. You know, we talk about these things over and over again. You cannot underestimate the extraordinary nature of this kind of claim. If you can't trust testing, expert testing of drugs, it really casts the integrity of the system in doubt. In the case of the affidavit in the Farak case, there is an internal attorney general investigation prior to Attorney General Healey coming into office. And the accusation here is that the information was generated by that investigation that would have serious implications in pending cases and wasn't turned over. Well, someone would say, who cares, right? They'll be turned over ultimately. Well, someone's in jail. In jail with a sentence that might be vacated or a plea that could be set aside while this issue is unwinding. So that's what the who cares is. And it says something very troubling about the failure of the government to turn over evidence.
Yeah. And presumably, it may have been a difficult time for the government to do so because it had this other drug lab scandal going with Annie Ducan right before the Sonia Farak case came out. Mm. Just briefly, Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz is delivering his State of the Judiciary in about 40 minutes or so. Any sense of, you know, the big priority or the big theme from that speech?
He has been very outspoken about urging the legislature to eliminate mandatory minimum sentences. Talked about it a few years ago. I would predict that that's what he would be doing now. And that in that he joins a chorus of prominent people across the country who want to look at the mandatory minimum sentences largely generated by the drug war as failures, not as successes. And I think that's what he'll likely focus on.
So if lawmakers don't listen to the ruling, they may have to listen to Chief Gantz's
speech.
Well,
they'll have to listen to him. Whether they follow is another question.
WBUR senior legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. Thanks for being with us.
You're
as
welcome.
Always. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, we remember Leo Baranek, a man described as a dean of Boston's intellectual community. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.